He rose from the boiler room with the ticket sales department to an executive office in just a couple of years, thanks to persistent pursuit of his goals and a whole lot of phone calls. Growing up in Indianapolis, he loved basketball, but he played rugby. It provided an outlet for his competitive spirit, one that carried over to his college career at Indiana University. He knew he wanted to work for a professional sports team in management, like about a million other college kids, so he went to law school in Boston. From there, he had a couple of internships, then he returned to Indianapolis to try to begin a career. Finally, through a connection, he landed a job with the Pacers in the ticket sales department. About 100 times a day, he picked up the phone and tried to sell ticket packages for a struggling team stained by off-court issues. He was laughed at, hung up on, and denied time and time again. But with a rugby player's tenacity, he hung in there. It took a lot of hard days and a lot of hard nights. But after a couple of years, he had his dream job. At least for now. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Peter Dinwiddie.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
All right, today's One-on-One episode comes from the fifth floor studios, the Miscommunications, downtown on the Circle. We're here with the Pacers executive. Peter Dinwiddie has a great story about his rise from the sales department to an executive position as vice president of basketball operations with the Pacers. We're going to get into that story right away. Now, Peter, you're from Indianapolis.
That is correct, I am.
Went to Cathedral.
Yes.
And I know you did participate in sports at Cathedral, right?
I did. I wrestled, I played soccer, played football, and I played rugby. So a little bit of everything there, Mark.
No basketball career?
No basketball career.
Not even as like a junior high kid or anything?
You know, I played basketball growing up, but I wasn't skilled enough to play at the high school level.
Was that your favorite sport, though, or was something else your favorite sport?
You know, I did. I loved the game of basketball. Always have. I enjoyed the game, and it was my favorite sport, and it still is my favorite sport.
Okay. What was your favorite sport to participate in then in high school, though?
You know, I really became attached to the game of rugby.
Yeah?
I enjoyed it a lot. I actually went on to play rugby at Indiana University. So played 4 years in high school, 4 years in college. Then I went on to play post-college career as well.
Okay. So, what is it about rugby you like so much then?
I'm kind of a competitive person by nature, and rugby is an extremely competitive sport. I like it's nonstop. It's 40 minutes a half. But unlike football, the ball doesn't – there's not a break after every possession.
Yeah.
So it's nonstop movement, a lot of action. I enjoy the physical component or aspect of the game as well. So
that's kind of interesting because you're not a big guy. You don't look like a bully type of athlete or whatever. So where does that competitive instinct or whatever come from, you think?
You know, I guess it must be born with
genetic.
Genetic. I mean,
so I'm told, word on the street is that I know you play basketball now, pickup games, and that you're a tenacious defender. So you like that part of it, huh?
Yeah, no, I mean, I enjoy competing. And I, you know, no matter what I'm going to do, I'm going to give it my best and play. You know, I loved practices as much as games. I thought practice were, you know, always extremely enjoyable, a good time because you get out there, compete, and have fun no matter what you're doing. Go hard and give it your best. So whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to get out there and give it my all and do it to the best of my abilities.
Well, that carried over to your professional career, and we'll talk about that later. Growing up, did you go to a lot of Pacer games as a kid?
I did. Yeah, I attended a lot of Pacer games growing up. Always enjoyed going to Market Square Arena. I didn't go to too many at the time, Conseco Fieldhouse. You know, most of my childhood was spent at Market Square Arena. But I enjoyed the venue. A lot of good times, great memories at MSA.
Favorite moments, favorite players, what sticks out in your memory from going to Market Square Arena as a kid?
I always thought when the place was packed, the energy in that arena was tremendous. I know the team struggled at times and the support wasn't there. But once Donnie turned it around and consistently the product was phenomenal, I thought the crowd support and the energy in the building was a lot of fun. I mean, obviously, you have so many great Reggie Miller memories, a lot of the Toto Dale Davis memories from those teams and the way they competed. And, you know, they always had the underdog mentality, but they always seemed to get over the top and compete and, you know, be right there on the cusp of getting to the promised land or getting to the finals.
Yeah. So what time period are we talking about? Are you going to games in the 80s?
Or? Yeah, I was definitely. I was born in 1977.
Okay.
So the 80s,
late 80s,
they struggled a little bit, but then the 90s, things got going and, you know, it was a lot more enjoyable during my high school years.
Get autographs?
I have a couple of autographs. I was cleaning out my closets a couple of weeks ago, and I found a ball that Clark Kellogg had autographed. I had Mel Daniels autographed an old program. And so I didn't have a ton of autographs from the Pacer players, but I definitely had some.
Were you a guy that was hanging out after games to try to get one, or where'd you get
them? Not really. I didn't really hang out post-game too often. Every once in a while, my mom would take me to a meet and greet at the finish line. A Pacer player would be in the mall or at the shoe store signing autographs. So they'd have an ad in the Indianapolis Star. My mom would see it taking, you know, I have two brothers as well. So she'd pack up the car. We'd go over there and see the guys, but really nothing post game.
Yeah.
You know, we had school early, get up. So weren't really sticking around too late to hang out and try and get autographs.
When you went to IU, did you go there with the intent of becoming an attorney? Was that always the thing, get a law degree?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say from day one, but eventually as my school career kind of played out and started to do some research, I figured I was a political science major, so I wanted to, you know, law school was probably a good step, good avenue for me to take post-grad, post-undergrad.
Your dad's an attorney, right?
My dad is an attorney.
What kind of attorney thing?
He does mostly real estate transactions.
Okay.
A lot. He deals with mortgages on a consistent basis, but, you know, he can pretty much do a little bit of everything on the business side.
So that appealed to you from the beginning. When did the idea of something related to sports come into play then?
You know, I think it was probably during my junior year. And initially, I had seen a lot of or heard a lot about the agents. And at the time, Jerry Maguire was an extremely popular movie. So I'd seen that, and I was like, I'd always been loved sports and loved the game of basketball. And so I thought maybe if I went to law school, I might be able to use my law degree in the sports industry. And one way to do that might be as a sports agent.
Okay.
And then I did some more research and found out that a lot of front office execs running different football and basketball franchises have a law degree. So I figured, you know, there are a couple of different avenues you can take. You could maybe go on the agency side, or you could go on the management side.
Did you have any thought at all about getting involved with the basketball program at IU, like being a student manager, that type of thing?
I didn't, just because I was playing rugby, and rugby, you have a fall and spring season. And so I really didn't have any time to – I probably would have been smarter to me looking back on it, maybe to, you know, do a little bit more. But I enjoyed my time at IU playing rugby. I don't really have any regrets of the way I've done it.
And rugby is a club sport?
It's a club sport.
At IU. So tell me about that. I mean, like, where all would you guys go to play? How many games would you play? That kind of thing.
We play probably 8 games in the fall, and then probably 7 or 8 regular season games in the spring. And then they have a national tournament. So then if you qualify for the national tournament, then you play 2 rounds and you go to the Elite Eight, then from Elite Eight, Final Four. So you can play throughout the month of April.
Any good rugby stories? Any good stories from your rugby career?
You know, I mean, my junior year, the team, we made it to the Final Four. So that was in San Francisco, California. So went out to San Francisco and competed in the Final Four. Also during my junior year, we played our spring break. We toured, went to Ireland. So we had 3 matches in Ireland. And I was actually in the St. Patrick's Day parade in Dublin. So, I mean, that was an unbelievable experience.
Why? Why were you in the parade?
Our whole rugby team was in the parade. So it was, you know, a great experience, a lot of fun. Probably the only time I'll ever be able to be in a St. Patrick's Day parade in Ireland. So it was fun. I mean, those are great memories, great people. I'm still extremely good friends with a lot of the guys that I played with at IU. And a lot of the guys I played with post-undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in law school, I played in Boston. Still friends with some of those people. So, you know, it's a unique sport. It's a challenging sport at times, but it really, a lot of the life lessons the game of rugby taught me have served me well in my professional career.
Okay. And then what life lessons do you learn from it that helped you in your career then?
Work ethic, you know, the team isn't good, you just don't show up on the pitch and you're automatically rewarded, or you're a good team. In order to achieve the level of success the team wanted to achieve, you had to do work on a daily basis, every day of the season. And so it's that mentality where you just have to, you know, another team is putting in the work. What can we do to outwork them? And that's what we did. And that's, I don't believe the team has been back to the Final Four since 1997.
So you get out of IU and you go to law school in Boston.
Yes.
Why Boston and not someplace around here?
You know, I'd spent majority of my life in Indianapolis, Bloomington, Indiana. So I just wanted to get out and see a little bit more of the country. I'd never been in Massachusetts. I'd always heard good things about Boston. So I figured I would, after I was accepted into the school, I figured I would move to Boston and just see, you know, what life was like outside of Indianapolis. You know I work
all day. Out of law school, Dinwiddie returns home to look for a job and finds out he has to work his way up when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with the Pacers Vice President of Basketball Operations, Peter Dinwiddie. He came back to Indianapolis after he graduated from law school, but he couldn't find the job he wanted. So his climb began from the bottom rung of the ladder. Okay, so you're done with law school. Is that when you come back home?
Yes, in 2004, I moved back home.
Okay, and you want to get into sports somehow.
I looked, when I was done with law school in Boston, I pursued a career in Boston in the sports industry, was unsuccessful, came back home in May of 2004, took the bar exam in July of 2004, and then during the time, I think from July until September, September's when I figured out that I passed the bar exam. I did as much networking as possible, did as much research as possible, and looked for any type of opportunity that might be available in the sports industry where I might be able to use more of, I guess, a legal position in the sports industry.
Yeah. So who all did you contact?
I contacted everyone. Yeah. And I mean,
you're writing letters or you're phoning?
I was doing both. I was, you know, emails, letters, phone calls, you know, whatever I could do to get in or receive a response, I was doing.
What kind of response did you get?
You know, the responses I received were positive, but they just, people were willing to meet with me and help me, but they just weren't leading into an opportunity. And so I had student loans that I had to begin repaying. And at some point I knew that I had to find an opportunity, which was going to, you know, I was going to receive some type of income or some type of salary so I could begin to make some of the payments that I needed to do to live on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. So you did what?
I worked at the Finish Line as a contract attorney, and I worked in their legal lease administration department. And I started doing that in January of 2005.
Okay, but you didn't stay with that for that long, right? I mean, you still wanted to get with a team somehow.
Yeah, my goal was to try and work for a team. But like I said, I wasn't successful.
I assume at this time you had contacted the Pacers probably already, right?
I'd contacted the Pacers. They didn't have anything on their operations side. You know, at the time, they didn't have anything on their business side either. And so I took the position with the Finish Line.
How did you get your foot in the door then with the Pacers?
I continued to, after I was with the Finish Line, I was grateful for the opportunity, but I knew that I wanted to try and get back into the sports industry, so I did some more research. I found out actually an individual I played rugby with, Trent Hahn. His father, Greg Hahn, was good friends with David Moraway. David at the time was the GM of the Pacers. Mm-hmm. Greg wrote a letter on my behalf to David Moraway. David reached out to me. David said he'd be more than willing to meet with me. So I set up an appointment with David Moraway, met David at Starbucks on a, I think it was Tuesday morning, about 9 a.m. Met with them, told him what I wanted to do. He said he didn't have anything on the operations side, but he thought they had an opportunity on the business side. So if I was really willing to dive into it, he would reach out to Ben Milsom, who at the time was the director of inside sales, put in a good word for me. And then if you know, I've wanted it, I might be able to receive an opportunity as an account exec on, in the inside sales department.
Uh-huh. And that's a fancy title for a ticket salesman, right?
100%. Ticket salesperson at the bottom of the total
Yes,
pool.
You started at the bottom, and that's kind of the point of the story, because I know a lot of people out there want to be a GM or whatever, want to be a sports executive, and they're not sure how they go about it. And if they are sure, they don't necessarily want to do what you did, you know, to start out in the boiler room, so to speak, picking up the phone 100 times a day and making phone calls trying to sell tickets. And you had the unfortunate timing of doing this during the lean years for the Pacers, you know, after the brawl and when the team wasn't making the playoffs. And, you know, there were some off-court incidents that kind of stained the franchise's reputation. Tell us what it was like during that time, just trying to be a ticket salesman for the Indiana Pacers at this time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie. It was definitely difficult. They always say it takes 5 no's to get to yes. You know, at that time it was probably 30 no's to get to yes. But I think that's where the mentality that you develop, you know, in rugby.
Yeah, this is where your background comes into play.
100%. The competitive having to drive spirit. And having, you know, being competitive and knowing that you're going to do whatever it takes to be successful really helped me achieve my goal of transitioning from the business side to the basketball side. So I would pick up the phone, make, you know, 100 calls a day, but I would come in early. I would figure out exactly what my day was going to look like so that I wasn't wasting time when I came in. I'd pick up the phone, be able to make the calls. I'd stay late, organize what, you know, my objectives or goals for the next day, so that I knew how I would attack each and every day and hopefully be able to generate as much revenue as possible. Because in order for me to continue to exceed or continue to advance within the sales department, you're based on the bottom line. You're based on your bottom line, and that's how much revenue you're able to generate. So I was trying to generate as much revenue as possible.
Yeah, and how did you go about convincing people to buy tickets or season ticket packages? How do you convince people?
Yeah, I mean, full season, half season, partial group.
What were you telling people when the team wasn't making the playoffs and that type of thing?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking the game of basketball. You know, at the end of the day, you're selling a product, and the product is Indiana Pacers. And I've, you know, grown up in the state, grown up in the city, I believed in the product, and I was selling the plan, with the team, what they're trying to do each and every year, what we're trying to achieve. So in the hope, and, you know, there are a lot of people in the state that enjoy the game of basketball. So there are a lot of people who are receptive to taking your call. Now, once you're able to get them on the line, now it's your job to convince them. Like I said, you know, you weren't able to convince everyone, but talking the game of basketball and just trying to overcome some of those obstacles with some positive inside information as to, you know, what the direction of the team is going to be in the future.
People laugh at you?
You know, not too many people laugh, but some people weren't too receptive.
What would they say? Like, what kind of responses did you get?
You know, I mean, some of the people, just somewhat rude, just, you know, not too supportive of the direction of the team, you know, hang up on you. But, you know, you got to overcome those obstacles and you got to continue to stay focused, stay determined. And you can't let what one caller did impact the way you're going to, you know, treat the next caller.
Yeah. Was it hard to kind of stay up and stay positive when you're getting, you know, 10, 15, 20 consecutive no's and people hanging up on you and that type of thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, I mean, mentally it was challenging, but you just had to have the mindset that you're going to overcome that or else you weren't going to be successful.
What do you do? Do you get up and go for a walk for a minute to try to get your bearings back after a while, or any particular technique?
Mental health walk here and there just to remain sane. But yeah, I mean, you did what you had to do so that you could get back on the phone and have success.
What kind of commission does a ticket salesman get? Do you get a certain percentage of
I don't know what it is right now. At the time when I was selling, it was a 10% commission.
Yeah, 10%. Okay. Yeah. So you're calling individuals, really not. Did you call businesses too, I assume?
Yeah, definitely called businesses.
Hoping they would buy a season ticket or a package of some kind and it's a tax write-off for them, right, as an entertainment expense. And
yeah, no, it definitely is. I mean, yeah, we would focus on corporations and then individuals. And
okay.
Trying, you know, whatever we could sell, we were selling season ticket, half season, 11 game group tickets.
Do I remember correctly that if you were like had the best success or whatever, that you get your tie cut off
do. If you had a sale that was greater than $10,000, then if you're wearing a tie at the time, your tie would be cut. So.
And that was a good thing. So you knew not to wear good ties. Is that it?
Exactly.
So to get more than $10,000, that has to be what? Probably a half season package or something? Or?
Yeah, I mean, at least a half season. Yeah. Most of them are full season ticket packages.
But all along, your ambition, though, was to get into a more executive position.
And yeah, I gave myself a goal about 2 years to try and transition over from the business side to the basketball side.
Okay. And how long were you in that position then? How long did it take?
It took 2.5 years.
2.5 years. Yep. So you stuck beyond 2 years.
I stuck beyond it just because I could kind of see things moving in the right direction, and I could see somewhat the light at the end of the tunnel. So I didn't want to give up yet. I wanted to continue to stay at, you know, concentrate on my goal and trying to achieve the task at hand.
Did you ever come close though to saying, forget this, this ain't going to work, I'm tired of it, I want to go practice law somewhere, you know, I've got a law degree, I want to use it?
Not really. Yeah. I was pretty determined and pretty focused that I was going to try and achieve my goal, and so I was going to give it that 2 years.
Okay, are you living at home at this time?
You know, I was not living at home. Okay. I was living in a rental property.
Yeah.
And so I think my base salary in 2006 was $13,000. So it definitely wasn't the highest paying job.
But you're also a bartender during this time, right?
I did. I bartended twice a week at the Mousetrap.
Yeah.
One of Indy's finer establishments.
Yes. And you would get home at what time? Because you're working nights, obviously.
Yeah, I worked a Thursday night shift and the Saturday night shift. I would probably get home between 4 and 5 a.m.
Really? So on a Thursday night, you'd get home at, say, 4 a.m., but you got to be in the office the next morning at 7:30 or 8?
Yes, 7:30, 8.
So you're going on 2-3 hours sleep?
It was difficult at times. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you're not well-rested, a lot of sleep. Mentally, it's hard to be sharp. I mean,
sure.
I was a little tired and a little edgy at times, but I knew this was my best opportunity to achieve my goal. I just wanted to continue to stay focused and stay determined, stay motivated. And, you know, eventually I could always catch up on sleep, which I always did.
But I would think on some of those Fridays, you bartended the night before, you got home at 4 or 5 a.m., you got 2 or 3 hours sleep, you're in there Friday trying to sell tickets, you know, and somebody's hanging up on you or being rude to you. There had to be moments when you just wanted to go off on somebody, you know?
Or
walk out the door and go home, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, you definitely have your moments, but, you know, I never wanted to represent the franchise in a negative manner, so.
No, it wouldn't be a good idea to do.
Not at all, especially when you're in inside sales at the bottom of the totem pole.
Yeah.
You're probably on a pretty short leash, so, you know, you always got to remember where you are and what you're trying to achieve.
Dinwiddie's dream has a breakthrough when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with the Pacers Vice President of Basketball Operations, Peter Dinwiddie. He kept his head down and worked hard in the ticket sales department for a couple of years. Finally, his performance raised some eyebrows, and team president Donnie Walsh wanted to meet the law school grad making waves. So what's the breakthrough that gets you into this position you're in now, Vice President of Basketball Operations?
You know, Donnie Walsh at the time was CEO, and he found out that there was an attorney working in the inside sales department, and Donnie's an attorney himself.
Mm-hmm.
So Donnie wanted to find out why there was an attorney working in inside sales. And so Donnie talked to Brenda Smith, and Brenda reached out to me and asked me if I would be willing to meet with Donnie. And of course, I was more than happy to meet with Donnie. You know, I was like, when? Right now? I mean, I'll come down. And so Brenda talked to Susie Fisher. They set up an appointment at a time which was convenient for Donnie. And then I met when I went and met with Donnie. And I told Donnie exactly what I wanted to do, why I was working in inside sales, kind of my aspirations, and had a, I guess, a pretty good conversation with Donnie, because when we're done, he told me he wanted me to schedule another meeting with Susie so that I could come back and meet with him again.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and met with Donnie on a second occasion. After the second meeting, he said, why don't you schedule another meeting? Schedule another meeting with Susie. And then after the third meeting with Donnie, so I just said, Peter, what I'd like to start doing is having you come down on a weekly basis, and I'll give you some projects. And then the next week, we'll review the project, and I can, you know, help kind of critique, give you some constructive criticism, let you know where you, you know, what was positive, what was negative, and kind of help you grow and see if, you know, one day it might become a reality that you can make the transition.
Okay, so what's an example of a project he would give you to do?
Yeah, I mean, I remember one of the first projects he gave me was, he said, now, Peter, let's say we wanted to move next year, but become a team that's going to be active in free agency. So in order to do that, we're going to have to dump some salary. So I'd like you to look and look at some players that we might be able to trade so that we could receive expiring contracts in return. But at the same time, I want to try and stay somewhat competitive. So make sure the players we're receiving in return aren't just throwaway players. Make mm-hmm. sure they could, you know, add some value to the franchise. And so, and at the same time, you have to construct all the trades within the confines of the CBA. So you have to make sure everything complies with the CBA.
Yeah. So did any of your test cases or your proposals actually get done?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, he took any of the ideas, because I think he was just giving me hypothetical situations.
Yeah.
I don't think it's actually the plan he was trying to devise, but
yeah,
he just wanted to get me thinking, and he would correct me and say, this is right. But at the same time, this issue comes into effect when you're doing a trade, and you didn't identify this issue. So now you know when you're doing it, this player had a signing bonus, and the signing bonus is going to impact, or this player had a trade bonus, the trade bonus is going to impact the trade and the amount of salary it's going to be on the cap the next year. So
mm-hmm.
just different rules like that.
Yeah, these deals are always a lot more complicated than most people realize. You know,
at times, they definitely seem to be.
So you become vice president of basketball operations. Well, that was that while Donnie was still here, or was that when Larry,
you know, Donnie
taken over?
In 2008, Donnie left to become president of the New York Knicks. And so Donnie called me into his office. He said, I'm going to New York. I'm not sure what exactly is going to play out here. I talked to Larry. I put in a good word for Larry. I said, all right, Donnie, I appreciate everything you've done for me. You know, what I've learned in the short amount of time I've been with you has been extremely valuable, and I'm extremely grateful for you giving me, you know, an opportunity just to work with you, you know, once a week. And so probably a month went by, and I was sitting in my cubicle, and my phone rang, and I looked at my caller ID. It said Larry Bird.
Now, you're talking about ticket sales cubicle. You're ticket back sales, selling tickets again.
100%, yeah. I'm still on the business side selling tickets.
Yeah.
So I picked up the phone, and it was Larry. Larry said, I'd like for you to come down to my office. So went down to Larry's office. Like I said, never met Larry before. Walked into Larry's, introduced myself to him. He said, I spoke to Donnie. Donnie said, or gave you a good recommendation. And based on his recommendation, I'd like to add you to my staff. I'm going to need someone with your skill set to work with David. And so, you know, I was extremely excited. I couldn't believe the words coming out of Larry's mouth, what was actually taking place in his office. And that was in April of 2008.
April of 2008.
Yep.
Okay. Now, when you get this offer from Larry Bird, you know, basically your dream, what do you do to celebrate it? Do you go home and, you know, anything in particular to celebrate victory? Or
no, I didn't. No celebration, just, you know, extremely happy. At the time, I was manager of group sales. And so the fever season had just started. So I couldn't leave my current position mm-hmm. until September of 2008. So from April of 2008 till September 2008, I was kind of in a dual capacity. I was working in my current role with the as manager of group sales, but then at the same time I was assisting David with various projects and assignments mm-hmm. just to make sure that once September rolled around, I was going to be able to transition smoothly and seamless and be able to begin assisting him full time.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but what does a vice president of basketball operations do? Let's take today. We're talking on a Monday. The summer league team is being formed and began practice tonight. We just had the draft last week. Can you kind of give us an example of what you did today, for example, in your role?
Yeah, I mean, just trying to finalize all, meet with Kevin, meet with Larry, meet with Donnie, and just making sure everyone's on the same page regarding free agency, holding internal meetings with the staff, making sure the communication lines are open, so that no matter what is done in free agency, everyone's on the same page, everyone is ready, and we're internally, we're not going to miss a step. We know exactly, you know, where we are. And so, and then a lot of what I deal with is salary cap management and making sure what we do complies with the CBA. So just running through various projections financially. If the salary cap comes in here, this is what the team would look like currently constructed. This is the amount of wiggle room we would have below the luxury tax. So just trying to look at various scenarios, looking at different plans. You have your, you know, plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, just mm-hmm. making sure you always are willing if you're not, if you have to call an audible, making sure you're ready and you're not going to be, you know, lost or there's not going to be anything missed during the process.
We don't know yet what the salary cap is, do we? Or the
No, that's going to be determined during the moratorium. Yeah. So July 10th, maybe July, I guess July 9th, we'll know officially.
You'll know then. That's July when you 10th, find out, huh?
Yeah, we'll be able to start signing for
So
agents.
You do have to have a lot of plan A's and B's and C's and so forth, huh?
Yeah, you definitely do. You always want to be as prepared as possible just because you never know what direction free agency is going to go.
Yeah.
And so the more information you have and the more prepared you are, you know, the more likely you are to make sure the team's in as good of a position to be successful.
Generally speaking, how much opportunity do you think there will be to improve the roster or make changes? You know, because, you know, as Larry has clearly stated, you want to re-sign Lance Stephenson, and he has stated there's a number we won't go over, and Herb Simon has made it clear to everyone that we're not going to pay the luxury tax, so you know what your ceilings are. So how much opportunity do you think there will be to
changes? Well, I mean, just echoing off what Larry said, I think re-signing Lance is our number one priority, and you're looking at a team that won 56 games, and there's a lot of, I think if you bring Lance back to the roster, the team inherently is going to get better. There's a lot to do with the continuity, the chemistry. And so having these starting five together for another year in a row, having these guys take steps in the offseason, the team is going to grow without, you know, actually adding new guys to the roster. You bring Lance back, and then you allow the same starting five that made the Eastern Conference Finals for second year to continue to grow and develop. I think you're going to have, you know, another good team that's going to continue to represent the franchise in a positive manner. Yeah, it's been a hard day's
night, and I've been working like a dog. How do the Pacers executives divide the responsibilities? And what's it like working for Larry Bird? Peter Dinwiddie explains that and why the Pacers plan to stay the course when One-on-One continues. We're back on One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with the Pacers Vice President of Basketball Operations, Peter Dinwiddie. He was hired for his current role by Larry Bird after succeeding in Donnie Walsh's Proving Ground. Here's Dinwiddie on what it's like working for Bird the executive and why the Pacers don't plan major changes. Can you tell people what the division of duties are between, you know, Larry, Kevin, Donnie, yourself? You know, do you have specific roles, or how does it break down?
You know, Larry runs it. Larry makes every decision. I look at my job as just to get Larry as much information as possible so that, you know, when Larry's making a decision, he makes it, you know, extremely informed decision. I get the information to Kevin. Kevin takes it up to Larry, and then, you know, we're all on the same page. Donnie's involved in every decision. Donnie's office is right next to Larry. Donnie comes in each and every day. And Donnie's an unbelievable resource to have.
He's kind of like a advisor or mentor, isn't he? Just kind of weighs in on what you guys are doing.
Exactly. I mean, Larry consults with Donnie, you know, on pretty much every decision he makes and gets Donnie's feedback. And it's great to have a resource like Donnie right next door to Larry, mm-hmm. where you can just bounce ideas off of. And everyone always adds, you know, something new to a conversation. So I guess the more informed of a decision or more educated of a decision you're going to make, I think the better for the franchise.
Yeah. But if you're going to pursue a trade, if there's an indication where, boy, we'd love to get this guy, let's see if that team is interested, who makes the phone call? The initial phone call anyway.
You know, Kevin pretty much mans the phones for the department, and Kevin has great relationships with all the other GMs and presidents in the NBA. So Kevin's the main point of contact for the team.
Okay.
And Kevin's out there talking to the other teams and just getting a feel for the landscape and a feel for the marketplace.
What kind of boss is Larry Bird? You know, people around Indiana feel like they know him. Well, he's a pretty withdrawn personality. He's a very blunt personality. You know, what's it like working for him?
Larry's the best. He's an unbelievable person. Extremely honest. Extremely, I mean, trustworthy. Straight shooter. And the one thing, I mean, Larry is so intelligent. I love having the opportunity to work for him and with him on a day-to-day basis, just because his knowledge, I'm able to pick up and learn so much from him every day. And it's what he's experienced throughout his life and through his career in the NBA and the decisions he makes, the issues he identifies, I would never be able to pick those out. So having the chance to learn with him is, you know, unbelievable for me. Yeah. And I, you know, extremely grateful and fortunate to be in a position. I say I get a PhD every day in basketball, having the chance to work with Larry, Donnie, Kevin.
Can you give an example of something Larry explained to you or said that kind of surprised you and thought, wow, that never crossed my mind, or that type of
thing? Just, I mean, locker room issues. How are players going to perceive certain moves, certain transactions, different players interacting on the court? He sees the game so well, and he sees how the pieces fit together so well, and he identifies things so quickly that might work against the grain, mm-hmm. and, you know, work against the culture that he's created with the franchise. And it's just his ability to pick those issues and qualities up so quickly is so impressive. And he's unbelievable with numbers.
I mean, I was going to bring that up, because a lot of people, because of his grammatical errors, tend to think he's probably not that smart. But you've told me that with numbers, he's...
Well, I mean, I think in everything he's extremely intelligent. Yeah. But with numbers, I'll have a calculator, and he's, I mean, some pretty complex equations, formulas. He has them figured out in his head before I'm done with the calculator. I'm like, I don't even know what I'm doing here, Larry. You know what I mean? You don't need me. You can, you know, figure it all out.
He told me once that he could turn on any game he ever played in, and he doesn't go back and watch his games, but if, you know, he happened to be watching one of the games he played in, he could instantly tell you what was going to happen next. Does he have a photographic memory like that, you think? I mean.
Yeah. I mean, he's got an unbelievable memory. One day I remember it was after training camp, there's a game on NBA Classic, and he knew each and every play what was going to happen. He was calling it out, and I was like, are you kidding me? I mean, I couldn't tell you. I remember rugby games, but I went back and watched it. I wouldn't be able to tell you, you know, what I was going to do on each and every play.
Yeah.
I mean, he had it down pat, and I was speechless. I was like, oh, my gosh, this is incredible, watching him tell me exactly what's going to happen on each and every play. And I mean, it wasn't a significant game. It wasn't a game where he had 60 some points or this and that. I mean, you know, it's probably a regular game where he had 40 and 20 rebounds and 10 assists or something.
What do you tell? I'm sure you're getting calls or letters from college kids like you were once, saying, hey, how do I get a job like yours? How do I get into sports administration? So what do you tell kids?
I think networking is extremely important, mm-hmm. because you never know where an opportunity is going to present itself. And if you limit yourself with the people that you talk to or talk with, you might not be able to receive an opportunity, because the people you're focusing on, an opportunity may never rise with them. So I think you got to expand your horizons, be extremely as broad as possible, and network with as many people as possible. And I mean, everyone now corresponds via email, via text. I don't think it hurts at all to pick up the phone and call someone and have a dialogue over the phone.
Is law school important?
For me, it was, just because I didn't have that basketball background, like more rugby background. So You know, law school, I think, helped separate myself, because the reason I was able to meet with Donnie was because I was an attorney.
Yeah, I know Donnie always thought that was important. Not necessarily what you learned in law school, but at least proved your ability to think and, you know, solve problems and so forth.
It definitely, I mean, law school just teaches you to think analytically, and analytically you want to gather as much information as possible so you can make an educated decision.
Yeah.
And you're doing that by obtaining information and trying to weigh everything collectively.
What's the most difficult thing then about your job and about talent evaluation? Is it like keeping emotion out of it, or, you know, what are the things that come up that cause teams to make mistakes? Because face it, some teams make really big mistakes in whether it's the draft or trades, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I can't speak for other teams, but you might, I mean, for us, one of the good things is we tend not to make kind of impulsive decisions. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I know a lot of times we try and make sure that we have all the information. Like a lot of times during the draft, a team will call with a minute left before you make the selection and make a pretty significant, or, you know, pretty attractive offer, but you don't have enough time to fully grasp how it's going to impact everything. And so, you know, by being reasonable, even though the offer looks good on its face, there's got to be some underlying reason that the team is making that offer. So, you know, just having the ability to stay focused and stay true to your principles and not, you know, really diverging from the task at hand.
How difficult is it to, quote unquote, stay the course? Because, you know, that's what Larry has stated you'll do. That's what Donnie did through the 90s, even though the team, you know, lost in the conference finals a few times. And a lot of teams don't do that. A lot of teams will make pretty significant moves when they're seemingly on the verge of breaking through. Is that a difficult thing to keep coming back and not making major changes?
As long as everyone's on board, you know, if you have the support of ownership and you have the support of the entire franchise, then it's pretty easy to stay on course.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you know in the long term what's in the best interest of the franchise.
Yeah.
And as long as everyone's on the same page, I think you'd be, you know, silly to get off the course.
Yeah.
And diverge from the track.
I'm sure you're aware. I know you don't listen to talk radio much or whatever. You're too busy. But, you know, there's certainly the line of thought out there that Pacers got to do something. You can't come back with this team. You know, you got to trade so-and-so, or you got to trade this guy, or you got to do something significant. How would you convince people that we can keep this team together, this starting five and our playing rotation together, and breakthrough next year perhaps, or whatever? How do you
won 56 games, made his Eastern Conference Finals second year in a row. At the end of the day, we're better than 26 of the other teams in the NBA. And if you re-sign Lance and allow this team to grow together and take the next step together, I think it's going to be a great product and a team that's going to continue to win games.
A lot was written, though, about chemistry problems within the locker room.
I mean, this is one of the best locker rooms I've ever been around.
But why did the team struggle when it did this past season?
You know, I wish I had the answer to that, Mark. I mean, I'm not 100% positive.
Yeah, I mean, I've got my theories.
Yeah, I think everyone has their theories.
I don't think it was actually guys not – yeah, I hear people saying they didn't get along, they don't like each other. I never felt that going into locker room as often as I did. But it was puzzling. I mean, the team got off to a great start. It went through some stretches where, you know, obviously Roy struggled, Paul George struggled at times. You know, do you feel then that – whatever those reasons were, that they can put that behind them and come back next year and not repeat the same?
Yeah, pattern? I mean, you know, even though there's a little bit of turbulence, you know, during the course of the season, as you said, I mean, I never saw any issues in the locker room. I think it's a great group of guys. The guys stood together. You know, I never really saw any cracks in the armor from some of the other locker rooms that I've seen.
Yeah.
I thought this was a tremendous locker room.
Theme question that I've asked everybody for the show, you know, when you sleep at night, do you dream about your job? Have dreams about either making transactions or researching or just basketball games? Or what do you dream about?
Nightmares.
Are they?
Waking up, what, I forgot to do this. Oh, man. I mean,
really?
Yeah, then I'll wake up and send myself an email, like, you know, make sure I take care of this the next day or this and that. So,
yeah.
Not really dreaming about this, you know, success, but something I might have forgotten to do. So then I'll wake up and I just send myself a little email reminder to make sure I take care of that the next day.
Yeah. Do you have like weird dreams where something really bizarre happens or you forget something or that type of thing? I mean,
no, I mean,
Larry has told me that when he dreams about basketball, he plays bad. you know, which is weird. And I've
I don't buy it.
He's told me that many times.
I mean, Larry played bad? Never.
But he's told me for the show that in most of his dreams, he plays poorly, you know, which there's no rhyme or reason for that, obviously. And then I have other people tell me they dream about forgetting their shoes, or some people wake up in a cold sweat, you know, that type of thing. So a guy in your position as an executive and an administrator, like what kind of things would be happening in a dream?
Made a mistake on a contract, you know.
Really?
I mean, didn't give yourself enough room financially, the amount of room you thought you were going to have, you didn't. You know, all of a sudden you're in the luxury tax.
the Pacers are paying the luxury tax because of you.
Exactly. I mean, that wouldn't
Simon's
be the
calling you up.
That would definitely not be the best of things.
One-on-One with Peter Dinwiddie continues in a moment.
All right. Thanks to Peter Dinwiddie for stopping by the One-on-One Studios. I realize he's not a major sports figure in Central Indiana, but his story should have universal appeal. It goes to show that most people have to make sacrifices and work their way up to get where they want to go. All that time working the phones, trying to sell tickets to an angry public, and then tending bar early into the morning made for some hard days and some hard nights, but they paid off. A lot of men and women want to work for a professional sports team. But are they willing to make those kind of sacrifices? Remember, if you want to hear this or any of the other stories from the One-on-One Library, go to the website at 1070thefan.com. Click on shows, click on One-on-One, click on the podcast link, and they're all there for you. You can reach me by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and I'm available on Facebook and Twitter, too. That Twitter handle just happens to be at Mark Monteith. I'll be back again next week with the story of a local professional boxer who's doing great things in and out of the ring, right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.